Your computer's not ready. Hey, guess what? Gobble, gobble. It's Thanksgiving, Jack. Whoop.
I think that was it. That means it's time for you to go.
Yep.
Oh, wait. I'm supposed to hit this button. That's your...
This month
on the Dystopic Boys.
When the aliens first invaded, they nearly destroyed us. They will be back.
I don't like this one.
The world needs you. You see things in a way we can't.
Blinded us to the truth!
Take a look.
You see, I take these glasses off. She looks like a regular person, doesn't she, huh? Put them back on, formaldehyde faced.
Do you wake from your finest fantasy only to return to your daily nightmare?
Mr. Wong!
Yes?
Welcome back.
Hey, formaldehyde face.
Finally.
Hey.
To another episode of the Dystopic Boys on the Dystopic Radio Network. One of your two survivors here this afternoon. Wendell, I'm here again with my co-host, co-survivor, Niles.
Yes.
How's it
I am
going?
Niles. We're good. Oh,
we're
man.
We're back.
This is, you know what? I'm just going to start.
It's been forever.
I know. I'm just going to start off this episode by saying, apologies for not being there. It's basically been a battle of schedules. I've been in New York and on a film, and I tend
it's
to just
all
work.
Your fault.
It's all my fault.
All
it's
of
all
it.
My fault. And then Wendell has his, you know, fine-tuned schedule.
That whole flying thing.
Yeah. So
I don't remember the password for my Google Drive.
Here we are. We just watched Ender's Game like a couple days ago, and then we just watched They Live, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Awful.
Last night. So we're cramming this all in, and here you go, episode 13 of the Dystopic Boys.
We
entitled,
were
titled,
they no, not they live.
They game.
They game.
They
yeah,
game.
They
we're
game.
Gonna go for Ender's Live, but that
but
doesn't,
that doesn't make any sense.
Any
they
sense.
Game makes a little more sense. So yeah,
welcome.
We're back.
Yes.
Again. So let's, you know what?
Basically, all I had to say is if we didn't get this episode in, I was going to
start crying or calling for my mother.
Yeah, was, start calling
so
for your
here
mother.
We are. Here, and here we are, Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's right. I almost
it
forgot
is,
to say.
I know. It is Thanksgiving.
Happy Turkey Day, Niles.
Happy day before Black Friday apocalypse.
As we speak right now, let's see. The bread is out of the oven. The sweet potato pie is out of the oven. That's right, sweet potato people, not pumpkin. I am from the South. Therefore, we will eat sweet potato pie, not pumpkin pie. The cornbread dressing is in the oven as we speak.
Ooh, cornbread?
Cornbread dressing. It's kind of like stuffing, but you don't stuff it because, as Alton Brown would say, stuffing is evil.
Wait. Elton Brown?
Alton. Not Elton. Alton. Alton Brown from Good Eats.
I was like, you're
stuffing is
confused.
Evil. Anyway, the 20-pound turkey will soon to go in the oven. It's going to be delicious. Anyway.
Nice.
But you know what? This is the Dystopic Boys, and the first thing we always do...
Have a drink.
That's right.
Is on drink.
So I went to BevMo, which...
Which, what's that stand for?
Which, beverages more, I guess, or more beverages.
Beverages
basically.
And more?
So,
whoa, I almost knocked my
so I was asking, I was like, I was going to go for a pumpkin, but then I was like, well, you know, we've had pumpkin before. I went to the holiday section and found this Laurelwood Brewing Company from Portland, very semi-local. It's called the Vinta Voma. Beer.
So instead of going for a pumpkin, you decided to go with something that, as the guy described, was like putting on a warm
sweater. Yeah, they're like, this
sweater.
This beer makes me feel like I'm putting on a warm Christmas sweater or
it's
holiday
kinda
sweater.
Kind of weird. I'm not sure how I feel about
which,
that.
Here we go. Let me pour.
I can't find our show notes, just
let
so you
me,
know.
Well, it's because you're updating. All right. Let me try the Vinta Voma beer.
All right.
Okay, here we
cheers.
Go.
Cheers. Cheers. It looks like a sweater, kind of. All right. Ooh, that's good. It's kind of like a...
That's actually really good.
It does kind of wrap
you in warmth.
That's weird, and I'm not ever going to describe it as that. It's kind of like a Cascadian Dark, kind of. It's got a nice bitterness to it that a lot of the, like, kind of winter ales don't. A lot of winter ales try to go with too sweet, so they end up being kind of that...
Yeah,
the same thing with a lot of pumpkin ales, where they end up being way too sweet, like kind of sickly sweet. This one is...
Here we go. This Wintervorma ale is as rich and complex as it is drinkable.
Since when is Laurelwood German, just out of curiosity?
Wintervorma, that's the only way I can say it. A blend of 6 malts and 4 hops create an ale with deep caramel character. I don't even know what kind of accent I'm doing right now. Spicy hop flavor and a dry roasted finish. It's spelled differently because it's wonderful. See?
It is delicious.
You can't say it any other way. That's good. Here we go.
Yeah, it's delicious. Just so you know, the show notes are not on the Google Drive in Dystopic Radio section.
They are, because I found them.
What's the title?
Oh. Sorry. I'm on template right now. I didn't change.
That's why. Show notes template.
I didn't get that far. Talk about cramming.
Right. Yeah.
I see you now. Here we go. Welcome to the show notes template for episode 13.
Okay. So we've had our drink. That means it's time to talk about the news of the day and various and sundry other items of importance.
We interrupt this program to bring
interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important
science fiction garbage.
Really, really quickly. Hey, really quickly, this is The Last Frequency. So, we were talking about, since we were watching They Live, starring Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Awful!
We were talking about his costume looking like... What's the guy's name from The Stand?
Randall Flagg from The Stand. Jeans that...
I could see your butt crack! Yeah, the long hair and the jeans we're talking about, it looks like Randall Flagg.
Kind of meant to be like the working man with the work boots and the...
I've seen recently, they're trying to get a movie version of The Stand made. And I think they've been fighting for a long time to get it adapted into a film, which I don't even know if it's worth doing film.
The Stand?
Yeah. I don't know if they're going to do a series or whatever.
I could see it being done kind of like they're doing The Hobbit, which we won't get into whether you love or hate the way they're doing The Hobbit, but I think it would work out like that, kind of doing a 3-part movie out of it.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll talk a little bit about rushing storylines a little later in the podcast.
But anyway, both Ben Affleck and Scott Cooper were attached to direct it originally and then dropped out. So now the news is, according to a couple places, they're looking at Bourne franchise director Paul Greengrass, who recently did Captain Phillips starring Tom Hanks, which I haven't seen. I want to see. But I don't know if Paul Greengrass, Mr. Bourne, will be the correct guy, because he's kind of more of the kind of shaky handheld type of...
Yeah, well, he's more of the action, follow behind somebody, like running action kind of guy. But the interesting thing about... The interesting thing about converting The Stand into a movie is, you know, movies usually have like one or two leading characters or like a cast of famous leading characters.
Well, there's always been the ensemble.
I agree. I think this is one where if you're going to go the ensemble approach, I think you have to go more the obscure actor route. Like, I don't think you can get like...
I would love to see newer talent brought into this as opposed to big...
Like, I don't think people. You can go and get a Morgan Freeman. You know, like, I don't think you can go... Although, what's her name?
I mean, you might
Mother Abigail could be played by... I'm trying to think what...
Now, I mean, do you remember, like, The Matrix? Remember the...
Yes, the Oracle I could totally see which one. Like, which one?
It doesn't
the
matter.
The first one or the
I think
second
either,
one?
I think either of them.
Either one would work. I almost think the first one I could see being a better
bring her
Mother
back.
Abigail.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that they're...
That'd actually be kind of cool.
I think there are a couple of those characters, like Mother Abigail, Randall Flagg, that definitely have a little bit more, like, they need to be cast with a certain approach.
A very strong...
Yeah, strong characters. Whereas some of the other ones I think could be no names that kind of like maybe this could be one of their first major project or something like that.
What about Randall Flagg being played by
He needs to be
the guy that plays the governor in The Walking Dead.
I could definitely see him playing.
Give him long hair.
Yeah, I could see him playing that character.
Yeah, he could play it.
But
I mean, so
yeah,
they're talking about it. I mean, Paul Greengrass is they're hoping for this, and you know, who knows whether or not that'd actually be a good choice or not. But I thought it was just funny that we were talking about that last night, and yeah. News. Anyway.
So obviously this is the first time I've read the show notes because I'm seeing on here that you say you played Call of Duty Ghosts and didn't like it. And what in the crap does that have to do with this?
Well, so Call of Duty Ghosts has to do with basically there's an organization or a criminal organization who took control of the Nomad missile up in space. Basically they had this Nomad missile satellite up in space, and the criminal organization took it over and started shooting the U.S. and basically blowing up half the U.S. So it's kind of this sort of in the midst of apocalypse kind of chaos, and
kind of a brought on by us kind of, or brought on by almost more of a modern day nuclear apocalypse.
Kind of our own people turning our own weapons against us in trying to take over, you know, something. I didn't get to the end of the game because honestly I didn't want to play it anymore, because like it was a Call of Duty game all over again. It was great because it followed sort of this elite group of soldiers kind of called Ghosts and trying to take out the bad guy. But you know, it played too much like
every other Call of Duty game.
And you know, I was originally playing it just for the story because it had to do with, you know, sort of our genre. And I just, you know, four levels into it, I was getting bored. I was like, well, really? They couldn't...
That's one of those games where...
I don't know. The graphics weren't...
They can't stray too far from the formula for that, because there are people that they buy an Xbox every year or every time one comes out, and then every year they buy two games. They buy Call of Duty and they buy Madden.
Yep.
Or they, you know, like these yearly franchises that come out every year, and that's the only things they play. And so... That's a lot of people, and so they risk alienating those people if they stray too far from the tried and true formula of that. Whereas it's the newer studios that have the luxury of going out on the limb and trying different things with gameplay and story and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I was wanting a little something. I don't know. I guess I'm just done with Call of Duty, period. So, anyway. You know, if you're into Call of Duty, it's Call of Duty. I mean, let me tell you, and it's, you know, there's some cool missions, you're doing some cool stuff, but, like the scaling down the building, I think was my favorite part, but yeah, I'm done with Call of Duty, whatever. And next we're coming up on the mid season finale of, The Walking Dead season 4.
I'm still behind.
Which you're still behind.
Just
I am
slightly less so.
I am a couple episodes behind. I have not watched, I think, the last... three, I think.
So, we are up to where... Oh, geez. Where,
I'm going to add some.
We were up to where... I think it was where Michonne goes out on her own. She leaves Andrea in the...
spoiler. Town.
In the governor's town.
Yeah.
I don't remember the name of the town. But anyway, she leaves Andrea there, and then she goes out on her own. It was the one where Glenn and
Maggie
get captured and tortured.
Spoiler.
And then it was right when they saw each other. Yeah, there's so prior, we should have brought this up at the beginning of the show. We need a spoiler alert bumper. There are going to be a lot of spoilers on this episode because we are talking about Ender's Game, which is still in theaters. We're going to be talking about the book, which the book's been out for like 15, 20 years. So that doesn't count.
Yeah.
But we will be talking about all that stuff. They live, again, who cares? It doesn't count. but there are going to be a lot of spoiler alerts for modern things, or for current things. So if you don't want to be spoiled, maybe wait to listen.
If you don't want to know about modern things, get out of here.
Oh, I see what you just added in.
Yeah, I just
I
added.
To watch that.
So, so anyway, Walking Dead, mid-season finale. It's going to be awesome. I have to catch up. But one thing I did sort of catch up on is Almost Human, the new show by Fox. One of the producers is Abrams. I'm glad he's not directing it, because then it's too much, probably like Lost.
Lens flare.
But I really liked it. And, you know, the problem is I can't do cop well, dramas anymore because it's the same thing. Buddy cop drama.
A little background. You know, yeah. Almost Human is set in the future where every human cop is paired with an almost human, a robotic cop that looks like a human, so almost human.
Android.
And it stars Bones from the new Star Trek movies.
Bones?
Yeah.
Is it Bones? Okay.
It's Bones. Also, we can't remember from Lord of the Rings. We can't remember his name. The guy that plays the Rider of Rohan.
Yeah.
I know. Keep going. Cannot remember him. Anyway, love him as an actor. I was really looking forward to this. You said you watched
Carl Urban.
Carl Urban. Yes, that's the guy. You said you watched it and you really liked it.
Yeah. You know what? My whole deal is it's like first off it's Fox. So first off the bat, I'm like whatever. I'm only gonna do maybe a comedy. Like isn't
Sleepy Hollow's on Fox? Wait, no, that's ABC. No, is that Fox? I think that's Fox.
Might be ABC.
The new show.
It might be ABC.
I actually kind of like that show. There's some good stuff going on that show.
But I mean, my whole deal with cop dramas is, you know, even buddy cop trying to be funny. It's just, I don't know. It gets old. They're, you know, kind of the same things over and over again. But this is awesome because obviously I love this genre. But Carl Urban plays a great character, and he comes in and he gets tired of these new androids, and he has to get a replacement, and he gets this older model, who was designed to be more human than
have emotion
the other ones,
and
to have emotions, yeah. And so now he's sort of. He's getting help from this older model android to solve crimes. And the cool thing is, you know, these crimes are, like, one of the episodes was there was kidnappings happening where they were pulling off skin from these people and putting them on androids.
That sounds gross.
To sell as sex robots. And so
sounds gross to that's really gross.
So they're trying to solve this crime, but you know, the crime was different, and the way they went about it was different, and the visuals look great. The CG is great for a TV show. The acting was great. I don't know. I really loved it. Probably because it's, you know, it falls into our category.
It falls into our category, and I think also there are some actors that, for good or for bad, you get to like what they do.
And whether it's the greatest
thing in cinema or television history, it doesn't need to be when you like the actor. And like I said, I've loved Carl Urban in everything I've seen him in recently, which granted is, you know, Lord of the Rings, Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking he was in something else. It's like the guy's Cumberbatch Flumberbutt. Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes.
I would watch him. I would listen to him, like, read a dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was, when we, you and I went and saw Ender's Game last Sunday, mm-hmm. or Sunday.
And the
Hobbit trailer came up, and they actually had, like, an extended clip of him talking as Smaug. And I loved it. I was like, I mean, I know it's, you know, edited voice work
Show
and things like
yourself.
That. But his uh-huh. approach and just everything he does, I really like the way he brings life to characters, or
yeah,
in
exactly.
his case brings kind of sarcasm to characters. You know, he's one of those actors that I think I would pretty much watch him in anything. Even if it's not my favorite show, I would still enjoy it for him. Same type of thing with Carl Urban.
Yeah.
That's a good call.
I can't spell, but I mean, basically, it's like iRobot meets a little Minority Report meets a little Blade Runner in terms of the world of Blade Runner, sort of the field of Minority Report in terms of it being sort of like cops and all that, and then iRobot in terms of,
speaking of Minority Report, just wait till we get to talk about Ender's Game with the whole like moving things around with his hands.
Oh yeah,
the simulation in the command school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Almost Human. Check it out. I think they'll be approaching fourth episode on Monday.
Yeah, I need to get caught up on that. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe we'll watch an episode or two tonight.
It's really cool. Anyway, let's go on to our first film.
Indeed. So, unfortunately, this week, yes, because of schedules, we were not able to get our fantastic Mark to do our readings.
Yeah, you know, so, the holidays and the late timing.
I was going to say, it was the holidays and the fact that we just started planning this like 3 days ago. Yeah, did not help things at all.
He's working tons at, you know, trying to prep for the holidays. So,
anyway, we are going to do our own little readings of this. So, Niles is going to read the little synopsis of They Live. Yeah, no pressure.
All right, here we go. They Live. Nada, a down-on-his-luck construction worker, discovers a pair of special sunglasses.
That was seriously his name?
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay, continue.
I'm trying to remember if he actually said it like Nada. Don't interrupt me. I'm not going to start over. They Live. Nada, a down-on-his-luck construction worker, discovers a pair of special sunglasses. Wearing them, he is able to see the world as it really is. People being bombarded by media and government with messages like, stay asleep, no imagination, submit to authority. Even scarier than that, he is able to see that some usually normal-looking people are in fact ugly aliens in charge of massive campaign to keep humans subdued.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. They Live. Directed by John Carpenter. Starring Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Again. Seriously?
You know what? This is his claim to fame, as opposed to Hell Comes to Frogtown.
I think this was better than Hell Comes to Frogtown, though.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean,
it doesn't take a whole lot.
Quality and acting and all that, it was better than They Comes
to... I don't know. The acting was terrible, though.
What, in this?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
That fight scene between him and that other dude, which I'm still not exact, the Mass Effect guy?
Keith David.
Yeah.
Keith David was fine. Oh, the fight scene was just...
That fight scene was like a 15-minute fight scene. Like, I'm sitting there like, really?
It's like the Family Guy chicken fight.
It is,
where
totally
all of a sudden
is.
They're just like, put on the glasses! He's like, no! And then they fight for 15 minutes.
But like five separate times, you think the battle's over and that one person kicked the other guy's butt, and then all of a sudden they get back up and go at it again. It's like, seriously? All right, okay, where's my watch? This is 5 minutes of my life I'm never going to get back.
It's like, we just have to put a fight in here between two friends, and it's gonna take up...
They weren't
up...
even friends, though.
Well, you know, they were you know, as much of friends could be in this film.
Yeah, that's true. Didn't exactly have a whole lot of depth to the storyline, let's put it that way. Or to the background of the characters, let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, you're talking about, you know, Rowdy Roddy Piper. But basically, this kind of drifter, Rowdy Roddy Piper, goes to work for a construction yard and then meets the Keith David's character. And Keith David takes him to this kind of, it's like this homeless shelter for... it wasn't even home. It was kind of weird because there was this shelter for, I mean, I guess the poor community. It was kind of funny. It was kind of a weird thing. But anyway, they go to this District 9 almost.
Yeah, it was very almost like a tent city. It reminded me of kind of like a tent city with like just people out in the open, like couches sitting out in a field. They have like a little TV set up that they're all, you know, sitting around grumbling about like the state of things.
It's basically like the people that haven't given in to these alien ways. But Nada, Rowdy Roddy Piper's character, basically sees there's something going on in the church next door, and come to find out it's this organization that's trying to spread the message of this alien invasion that's actually taking place underneath the skin, so to speak. And he finds a pair of sunglasses, and his point of view is changed, and he's able to see a bunch of things. I want to play a little clip here. This is when he first... This is just after he puts on the sunglasses, and he walks into a storefront, and he starts spilling his beans a little bit.
It really boils down to our ability to accept. We don't need pessimism. There are no limits.
It figures it would be something like this. Our nation,
our ideals. That was a president, wasn't it?
Excuse me. Just survive.
You know, you look like your head fell on the cheese dip back in 1957.
That's funny.
You're okay. This one, real fucking ugly. You see, I take these glasses off,
She looks like a regular person, doesn't she, huh? Put them back on. Formaldehyde face. That's what we got.
That's enough out of you. You get out or I call the cops.
Call the cops? You know what you need? You need a Brazilian plastic surgeon.
I've got one that can see.
You know, that just might be one of the greatest lines. Yeah.
He's a tall Caucasian male that doesn't appear armed, wearing sunglasses.
I don't like this one.
You take these off, she looks like a regular person. You put them back on, formaldehyde face.
Call the cops. Call the cops.
I mean, like, that line right there bests anything in Hell Comes to Frogtown.
I don't know. That's pretty high praise.
No, it's not. That's the sad thing.
He starts saying that he can see these people, and they're like, oh, he can see us, and they start talking into their
watches. Yeah.
Yeah. He's identified stupid Roddy Piper. Call the cops. I love that.
I actually didn't mind the storyline itself. Like, I actually think it's an interesting premise. The idea that there's a race living among us that is hidden from view. In this case, they're hidden from view by a transmitter
I really love the concept.
I like the concept. I just think that they could do a lot more with maybe not Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Well, and I think the whole problem I had with the film overall is they didn't really get into this issue very much. It was very much on the surface. Like, it was about him, and then he discovers glasses, and then he encounters a bunch of them, and then he has a big long fight with his friend about the glasses, and then they get in this firefight at the end where they just kill everybody.
Well, they find that there's a resistance that's creating these sunglasses so that people can see them, and they're trying to disseminate these sunglasses out to the population. And then at the end,
they all die. Basically.
They end up. Spoiler alert for a really old bad movie. They end up destroying the transmitter that hides these aliens from everyone. So now everybody's sitting in bars and watching TV and things like that. And all of a sudden, they're looking at the people sitting next to them, and they're like, "Whoa! Like, you're not right."
Yeah. So my question is whether or not they actually destroyed the main satellite that.
That's what I got from
or it's just that piece of the city,
that locale, like that area.
Like, I mean, we can talk about more of this when we talk about Ender's Game, but we have in between these two films, because I love trying to compare these films that we watch. Ender's Game, we have a boy who's on this very global mission to save humanity.
Well, humanity was on the verge of extinction, and so therefore exactly. All of humanity pulls together to create the international fleet and all of that.
And then we have They Live, which is this very singular story about a guy who ends up finding out what kind of situation he's in and fights as long and as hard as he can to try to save what's left, and maybe he only by the end saves this certain section of the city.
We don't know what else is going on in the world. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Elysium, right? Like, Elysium is all set around L.A. and Matt Damon at the end, that whole thing about the shield over the city and not allowing any space launches and all that stuff. We don't know what's going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
In Elysium. All we know about is the area of LA.
Yeah. And I think this is the same thing. We don't get this worldwide sense of what's going on. Besides, I think that was the president on the TV. Cause he's like figures, I assume that was the president. But we really don't get a sense beyond the city limits, and whether or not at the end that they actually, expose these aliens to the whole country or not, or the whole world for that matter, is unknown to us. So, and the coolest part about this story, I think, is this issue of whether or not they're doing any good by exposing the aliens at this point, because it's like the Matrix, right? Where all of a sudden Neo is exposed to the truth, and the internal battle that happens is whether he was better off just playing by the rules and playing in the system, or going against it.
Well, that gets into other ideas of what's better, to be blinded to the truth but happy, or free, you know, free to make your own choices but in a miserable world.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting thing about a lot of these things is, you know, when we're infiltrated and by aliens like in They Live, or mm-hmm. you're in some little gooey pod in the Matrix.
Gooey pod.
If you don't, what is it begs the question, what is reality? Is my reality what I know? If my reality is what I know, then why would I care if I'm in some pod? Like, you know, I don't know. It's a weird kind of.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, once you're exposed to the truth, you know, what do you do? What do you do once you know it? Do you try to? I mean, you can't go back, obviously.
Well, and in They Live, these aliens were not just like just around them. Generally, they were the cops. They were part of government. Like these aliens had become throughout all of society. So it was not just like there were a few here and there within the working force. Mm-hmm. It's like they were. I don't know if the president was or not, but like they were the government. They were in the police. They were in courts. You know, they were all over.
And so, I mean, you know, the whole idea of exposing, like the end, you know, the end goal is trying to expose the truth and, you know, show people that there's aliens among us. But, you know, is that going to do anything?
There was one other element to it, though, that didn't. There was also that element of the elite that it wasn't just that we haven't touched on yet. It was not just the aliens versus humans story. It was the elite.
They were the upper
rich,
class.
The upper class.
They were the
rich
upper class,
that knew about the aliens. That basically were in conjunction with the aliens, keeping the poor, keeping the weak down, and you know it kind of. By using subliminal messaging, and that got into a little bit of
the messaging,
we were talking about kind of like Branded, where you know these ways of marketing that get to people's core psyche that they don't even realize what's going on. Mm-hmm. They just know I want a cheeseburger, or I want to sleep late, or whatever it is.
I like the on the dollar when he puts the glasses on. There's this great scene where he's able to see what these messages, what media is actually telling him, and the dollar bill, it says, this is your God, or whatever.
Oh, that's right.
On the dollar bill. I saw on The Verge, you can buy this prop replica that is basically this book, or this magazine that has, it has the slogans, like sleep
that's
or
conform.
Awesome. You can hear.
Oh,
You can buy this prop that has, you know, the fonts and everything else, but it has these words written out in magazine form, like it is in the movie. You can buy this prop replica. And then also mention, this is also the 25th anniversary, right? Yeah, it's the 25th anniversary of They Live this year. So, congratulations to They Live for making 25 years.
I think it would be interesting to see this movie remade with somebody that's actually a little bit more of a mainstream actor, not somebody that's just a, hey, I'm a converted professional wrestler.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't remake this with The Rock. As much as I like The Rock in some action movies, do not remake this with The Rock.
No, totally. We should use another wrestler for the remake.
No,
right?
No, not at all. Unless it's Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then
this would be. This would be a cool remake, and really dive into sort of. I mean, you don't have to necessarily. I liked that we don't know how it started.
That's
like,
true.
I mean, the whole storyline, I really liked how we're just kind of dropped in like he is.
We're basically following the character, right? Yeah. We're following the character that he's just this homeless guy wandering around looking for work, and all of a sudden he hears something out of a church that he thinks is a little weird. He goes in to investigate and finds sunglasses, mm-hmm. and he puts them on, and like, holy crap.
Yeah.
That type of a scenario.
With the remake, I would like to see more of this developing.
Well, you could after he discovers that, you know, when they start to talk to the resistance and stuff, maybe you could get a little bit more background at that point, that the resistance maybe knows a little bit more about the history of this, where when they're introduced to the resistance explains, like, you know, these aliens came here, you know, 150 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And since then, they've been infiltrating our society. And they've, you know, a little bit of explanation, but without breaking this illusion that we are seeing things from this character's point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know necessarily that the story needs a full background. But I think one thing for me is I would have rather been more invested in the character by the end. So when we get to the end, it's more of this like sacrificial moment for this greater cause, well, kind of thing. Because at the end, it was just kind of like, oh, we have the last. I told you we had 10 minutes left, and they got to the radio station with 10 minutes left in the film, and you're like, and you said, I wonder how they're going to wrap this up.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how are they going to wrap this up in 10 minutes? Well, I think part of that comes down to the actor. Like, I think.
Well, yeah.
Like
sure.
I think that it's just, I mean, the fact is that Roddy Piper is not a good actor. And your ability to empathize with him, your ability to put yourself in his shoes is limited because he's not a very good actor.
Yeah, but you know what? I know there are ways to turn Roddy Piper into a better. Throw him into a better put together story, just in terms of how you write it and how you edit it together. I mean, I think, you know, they could have made you.
Yeah,
more
but at
invested.
A certain part, that's like polishing a turd
to a certain degree.
As MythBusters proved, yes, it's you can technically polish a turd, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to eat it because it's still a turd.
It's still a turd.
Like, you know. Okay. Anyway, I like.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, I really enjoyed the premise. The music was terrible. I don't have any of the music or anything.
You didn't like the music?
I did not. That theme song was... you know what? No. It was like a bad version of Jaws.
I don't have the...
It was like a bad version. It was like... Like, it was just... I was not a fan of it. It was very contrived to me. But overall, the storyline itself I actually really liked. Just the acting itself kind of... was very here we go. Was very limited.
Buzzing. Here, just give you a sense.
A little bit of the music. I couldn't.
Wait for it. Oh, I love this. I love this poster.
Oh, look, it's an 80s movie with a harmonica. And he even plays a harmonica at one point in the movie.
It's almost like The Stand a little bit.
Yeah, but The Stand had 80s. Better music than this.
Yeah, but it was still this kind of 80s Western type of... Yeah, the...
Except it wasn't set in the West. Like, why have Western music? The movie was not set in the West.
So this is...
Oh.
Anyway, I won't subdue you.
Yeah, please don't subject me to that. Subject? Subject.
Yes.
Me to that anymore.
Whoa.
Anyway.
So, yeah.
I'm not editing that out, by the way.
No, leave it. Of course. So yeah, here we. I mean, yeah, I liked it. You know, the visuals were great. I mean,
actually, for the time, the whole like he puts the glasses on and all of a sudden there's these weird alien faces. That was actually a surprisingly good illusion.
Now the effect that didn't work for me was the little robot.
Oh my word! The flying saucer like robotic things. That was straight out of Minority Report.
The little
flying robots that like looking at what you're doing and everything.
I think it's funny how you say out of Minority Report, or rather it should be the opposite way.
That's true because this movie was first. I choose to say that whatever movie was better, that the other movie stole from that, even if it was in the future. Whatever.
I liked the widescreen format and all that stuff. I think I'm comparing it to Hell Comes a Frog.
Wait, was it really widescreen?
It was.
Well, it was theater. I mean, it was like a theater. Two, three, five to one.
I'm thinking it was pretty extreme widescreen. But I'm thinking of it in terms of Hell Comes a Frog Town, because I think Hell Comes a Frog Town was like,
that was 4:3.
I
think that was
made for TV.
That
movie
was just awful, though. Okay. Anyway,
Shut your hole!
So basically, I think we can both agree we enjoyed the story itself. We enjoyed what they were trying to do with the story, but we felt it could have been a little better with a little different actor, or if it was remade today, it could be approached a little differently to make it a little bit more believable.
With the long ass fight scene between his friend and, you know, the 10-minute ending. Anyway, but it was good. It was good to finally see this film that like made Roddy Piper.
Let's just say the aliens in this were 1,000 times better than the froggies in Hell Comes to Frogman.
But
those were awful.
It's funny. You look at the mouths of the frogs and the mouth of the aliens, and they're like, I can barely
puppet move my mouth. I can't move my mouth because I have so much prosthetics on that I can't move my mouth.
It's too difficult for me. Call the cops. Anyway.
Okay. Well, let's move on. So our next movie is going to be Ender's Game. But before we get to that, we have a little song to play for the mid-episode break. This is a song from Ender's Game, the soundtrack, which if anyone has not heard it, I highly recommend listening to it.
Should we do that? Or should we end with another clip from
Let's end it with another clip.
I'm going to do the bubble.
I don't even know what's coming.
I'm going to do the bubblegum clip. This is the great.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass.
He walks into a bank.
Oi.
And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
See, like that clip right there just makes me want to hit my brain against a wall hard.
And I am all out of bubblegum.
Oh, no.
Cue song.
So awful. So, okay, correct me if I'm wrong. Where did that saying originally come from?
What?
I'm here to kick ass and chew bubblegum and I'm all out of bubblegum. Did that originally come from this?
Wasn't that
an Arnold Schwarzenegger quote in a movie?
I think it's got to be this.
Because I've heard that quote before.
I think it's got to be this.
Oh, it was so bad. Okay, during the break, we're going to look up exactly where we think that came from. Okay, so this is a song. This is track number 15 off of the Ender's Game soundtrack. It's called Command School. So this is basically when Ender is first introduced to the Command School, and he's starting to use the simulator and things like that as he thinks the simulator is.
And this is done by Steve Jablonski.
Jablonski
Mr.
of
Transformer.
Transformers fame, which love or hate the Transformers movie, the music's... I can't get my plurals correct.
I'm so glad that you are having trouble speaking today.
But here's the thing. It's Thanksgiving. We decided that we were going to have some mimosas this morning.
You better not accuse being slightly tipsy on the show.
Not tipsy, just enjoying a mimosa prior to the show. Okay, anyway, Command School.
Do it.
I'm just doing it.
According to T-shirt.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Nicole Spag from the Final Score and TMS Recommendals. You are listening to the Dystopic Boys on the Dystopic Radio Network.
Paper. Have you ever seen paper? Okay, so that means it's time for the Lost Pages segment the podcast. It's been
Lost
a while.
Lost Pages.
I know, it's been a while.
Woo!
But we're actually going to do things a little different today because the book that we're going to talk about, which is Ender's Game, also happens to do with our second movie, which, conveniently enough, Ender's Game. we're going to do a little synopsis reading of the storyline for Ender's Game, and then we're going to kind of talk about both the movie and the book at the same time.
How did that happen?
I know, it's convenient, right? Literally, I watched the movie with you on Sunday night, and Sunday night at about midnight, I started reading the book. By Monday night, actually, it was Tuesday.
Wait, really? I thought you read it before we went and saw the movie.
Oh, I've read it. I've read the book like 8 times.
I thought you reread it.
But I had not reread it. I had not read it in like 4 years.
Yeah.
So I started rereading it that night after the movie. And I finished it by about Tuesday morning. So about 36 hours later.
I don't think I've read it in like 10 years.
It was so good. Anyway, okay. Yeah. So the storyline. My voice, I realize, is not as dramatic as Niall's, but I'll do my best. Okay. Ender's Game. The Earth was ravaged by the Formix.
Wait, what? You have to do it. Dramatic.
Oh, crap.
Title first, and then read.
I said Ender's Game.
Yeah, but you're like rushed into it. You got to...
Ender's Game. The Earth was ravaged by the Formix, an alien race seemingly determined to destroy humanity. 70 years later, stop laughing.
Crap.
70 years later, the people of Earth remained banded together to prevent their own annihilation from this technologically superior alien species. Ender Wiggin, a quiet but brilliant boy, may become the savior of the human race. He is separated from his beloved sister and his terrifying brother and brought to battle school in orbit around Earth. He will be tested and honed into an empathetic killer who begins to despise what he does as he learns to fight in hopes of saving Earth and his family. Hey, I never claimed to be a voice.
Hey, you know what?
A voice
how
guy.
Many, how many takes we do with Mark?
We do at least 3 or 4. This is live, right? So yeah, whatever. It's great. Anyway.
I apologize for laughing.
I don't care. I laughed. I interrupted myself. So whatever. I need a drink.
Have a drink.
Okay. I thought you were actually going to talk to fill that space, but no.
I hit the button instead. I was like, I need a drink too.
Okay, right. So Ender's Game. This book, I've probably read this book 6 or 7 times now, and it's easily on my top 5 books that I've ever read for me. It's not a complicated book. It's something that literally someone, I would say anybody from 3rd, 4th grade.
This is on like middle school.
Yeah, this is middle school reading list. Yeah. I still think that it is one of the best science fiction books that I've ever read. And bar science fiction, for me, this is one of the books that I have enjoyed reading time and time again more than almost any book out there. During the storyline, this is set in a world where the Formix had attempted to conquer Earth like 70 years earlier, and they were defeated by the international. They were defeated by Earth through the bravery and heroics of a pilot named Mazer Rackham. And basically, then out of this, the international fleet is created, where their idea is to basically create the best soldiers, the best commanders to defend Earth. And they do this through the battle school, which they go and they get the best, the brightest children out there, which people are only allowed 2 children at this point. So Ender is considered a 3rd. So his parents actually had to requisition his ability to be born. Mm-hmm. And so he's born as a 3rd, which comes with its own stigmas and everything. In the book, he goes up to battle school as a 6-year-old, And
in the book.
In the book. He goes up as a six-year-old, and he gets basically moves very quickly through the ranks and ends up being a commander of his own small little what they call armies in the battle school. And these armies are basically fighting against other armies within the battle school in this kind of like zero-gravity battle. And the idea being that the brightest of the bright go on to either command school or tactical school to become the commanders of the commanders of the fleet or commanders of battle groups and things like that in the coming war with the Formix.
Yeah, because the whole big idea is to find the one person that can lead them to victory, right?
Well, we don't know that early on.
It is true.
All we know early on is that battle school is designed to find the brightest people to become commanders, mm-hmm. battle group leaders, tacticians, like all of this stuff. So we don't know if Ender is the one or not, but you hear Colonel Graf, the leader, the administrative head of the battle school talk, you start to realize that his feeling is that Ender is the perfect combination of his brother and sister, who had both washed out of battle school. Peter Wiggin, his older brother, is ruthless.
Quick into violence.
Very quick into violence and very, very like easy to kill and very ruthless. But because of that, it's difficult for him to be empathetic towards his enemy, which means that he doesn't know his enemy. Mm-hmm. His sister, his older sister, Valentine, is the exact opposite. She's very, very empathetic and she's very brilliant, but that empathy leads to her a softness that she's not capable of killing and pursuing the violence and the self-preservation that Peter, the older brother, has. Mm-hmm. Ender, they feel, is that perfect combination of self-preservation through violence, which they need in a battle leader, but at the same time, enough empathy to be able to know his enemy. You know, you have to be able to empathize with your enemy in order to know them. And if you know them, then you can predict their moves. Mm-hmm. Similar, different story, but similar to the Emperor Thrawn series, Star Wars. It's a three-book series where Thrawn basically is a alien commander who he studies his enemy. He studies his enemy mm-hmm. through art and music and science and all these different things so that he can know his enemy and predict their movements through all of their society, not just through their military commanders, but through the way that they think as a species. Yeah. So that's basically what they're saying is that Ender needs to be able to know the enemy. He needs to know the Formix in a way that nobody else can so that he can predict what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. You know, and then towards the end, he ends up, again, spoiler alert, he ends up moving on to command school and what you think is
more training.
More training and simulations with his former battle school mates and stuff. And then in the end, you find out that the simulations that they've been running have actually been him commanding the forces of the International Fleet through what they call an Ansible, which is an instantaneous communication device, where he thinks he's commanding simulations. In actuality, he's sending people to their deaths. And in the end, he does the one thing that nobody else could. He makes the decision that he feels that the game is stacked against him and that it's his graduation day. And he thinks that there's no way he can win, basically without cheating. So he decides to cheat. He sends all of his forces through straight to the planet and destroys the planet, thinking that they will kick him out of the school because of the decision he made. What he doesn't know is that he just destroyed the Formix home planet.
Oh yeah, remind me, is that his internal thing?
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be there anymore.
So in the book, when he sees the final battle, the what he thinks is a simulation that they've set up for him, he sees these, you know, just millions of Formic ships around the home planet, and it's hopeless. He has like a thousand. It's like literally 1,000 to 1 odds. And he knows there's no way he can win.
But thinking it's a game.
And so he thinks that they have set him up for failure and that basically he's going to fail. What they want to do is see how he fails. Mm-hmm. And he's done with it. He's done. He's like, screw it. I'm done. So he basically makes the decision that, you know what? If I'm done, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory. So he makes the decision. They have this weapon called the Little Doctor that can basically turn matter, separate the bonds that that connect the matter and basically turn it into
nothing. Chain reaction.
It's a chain reaction. Mm-hmm. So he decides to do the one thing that he feels will get him kicked out of the school, which is target that weapon at the home planet, which of the Formics, which will destroy the planet. And he feels that that is an unthinkable thing, that that's genocide, and that no one would ever do that. And so by doing that, he'll get kicked out. And so he does this, he destroys the planet. And then in the book, he turns around to hear applause and clapping, and the adults all around him are crying and saying, thank you, and all this. The movie approaches a little differently. The movie has the...
Still sort of the same.
It is, but in the movie, there's not an immediate reaction of joy.
Yeah.
In the movie, the people up in that audience chamber are more like talking back and forth, like, was that okay? Sure. Like, what happened? Like, it's like they don't know what to believe at first. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of talk about this whole book versus movie thing. The book is basically a bullet-pointed version of the... Sorry, the movie is basically a bullet-pointed version of the book. They really didn't change much in the movie as far as actually what happens versus the book. But it is very, very shortened. You know, there's only two battles that they really talk about in the movie versus... There's probably five or six that they talk about in the book in the battle school.
Yeah.
I really liked the movie version of it. I felt that, to me, it's almost like seeing a really, really well done trailer and then wanting to see the movie based off of that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this was like, if you saw the movie first, I felt it was a good movie on its own right, but that would make me want to sit down and be like, I want to see more about that and read the book.
Yeah.
And they are close enough in story that there's not that much that changes. So you could go from the movie and then go read the book and be like, oh, so that's what they were talking about through all of this stuff.
Yeah, because there's really not much that changed, right? I mean, it's pretty much...
The only things that changed, like
you said, the bullet points of the story, like, you know, the battle school, and then he moves up, and then, you know, this happens. And
so
then moves up.
The main differences are things like, for starters, they made him a little older. The actor that played him was 16. They made him out like he was more like 10. You never really get a sense of how old he is, but they definitely made the characters a little bit older. In the book, Ender plays a character that when he starts getting picked on or basically beaten up, he plays for keeps. So, you know, he grabs the nearest thing to him and will basically, once his enemy is down, once the guy who's antagonizing him is down, as he puts it in the book and the movie, he doesn't just fight to win this battle. He fights to win this battle and all the battles to come. So it's like, if he beats him now, he knows he'll have the same fight a month later.
Mm-hmm.
If he beats him now and then makes so that his enemy and the enemy's friends will never come after him, then he's won the war, not just the battle. And because of that, in the book, there are a couple scenes where he doesn't know it at the time, but he kills a couple people because they're coming after him. And once they're down, he just keeps going after them because he's like, I don't want this person to ever come after me again. The movie, they toned that down.
They toned it down, right? Yeah.
They toned that down a little bit. They changed his character from one of the, specifically the scene where Bonzo comes after him when he's in the shower. And, you know, they fight. And in the book, when Bonzo hits his head on the
he did
the
hit
fixture,
his head
he,
in the book?
He does hit his head or in the, I mean, he doesn't hit his head in the book, but basically...
He gets knocked
unconscious.
Yeah.
Ender doesn't stop in the book. He just continues to kick him and kick him while he's down. And in the book, he ends up killing him. He doesn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, Ender basically pushes him away. Bonzo hits his head on a step. He kicks him away, hits his head on a step. And Ender immediately goes over and knows that he's really, really hurt badly. Mm-hmm. And he immediately starts to ask, like, are you okay? Like, I never meant that to happen. And it does change his character some. It changes Ender's character from one of doing anything he has to do to prevent the next battle, the next fight, to one of, I was just defending myself. Once I've defended myself, then I'm sorry for what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So it does change his character a little bit, but other than that, you know, they skipped a couple little things. Like in the movie, he doesn't go to Rat Army. In the movie, they never transfer him.
Yeah.
In the book, he gets transferred from Salamander Army over to Rat Army. And then from Rat Army, he gets promoted to Commander of Dragon.
In the movie, he
goes straight from Salamander and gets promoted to Commander of Dragon.
Which is kind
of
funny because one thing I do remember, I mean, from reading this book 10 years ago, was the games that he played. Like the little mini games that he played.
The mind game, as they call it.
And I can't remember in the book, because the funny thing in the movie is he's playing the mind game and he is a rat.
Yes. In the book. The book, it's the exact same thing. The book, his character initially starts out as a mouse.
As a mouse, yeah. Which I guess is more of a mouse than a rat. But
so this mind game is basically a game that they play on their, it's basically an iPad. They play this game and this game is intended as a way for the leaders of the battle school to be able to see into what they're thinking.
Mental training.
It's designed to be like a almost like a Rorschach test.
Mm-hmm.
Like, present these problems and see how people react and then judge their psyche from that. Well, what they don't know is that the Formics have managed to, through the Ansible, find Ender and start communicating with him through the game. He doesn't know it. So they're basically changing this game and putting images into the game so that they're basically trying to tell him a message, which you find out later is that, you know, we know you're going to come for us. We know you're going to come destroy us.
But this
because of what we did out of our, we didn't understand what we were doing. Mm-hmm. Because the Formics are basically like a hive species. They're like bees. Killing one bee, you're not killing a sentient thing. You're killing like they describe in the book and the movie, clipping your fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
Killing one Formic is like clipping your fingernail.
You have to kill it at the root.
So to them, the Formics think that by killing one pilot in a ship, they don't understand the ramifications of that until it's too late. So they know that Earth is going to be coming for them, and they figure out that Ender is going to be the one to do it. So they communicate with him that, hey, we didn't understand. Our only request is that when it's all over, you take this egg for a queen, basically, and you find a place for it. You know, save us as
take
a
it
species.
Somewhere else. Yeah.
Save us as a species. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that we did wrong. We know that there's no getting around what happened, and we know we're going to be destroyed. All our request is that someday we be allowed to live.
Yeah.
Like I said, I liked the movie. I felt that one of our friends, Derek Schlicker, who was on another episode, said that he felt it was rushed. And I agree. It was definitely rushed. But what I liked about it is that it still hit the major points of the story. It did not completely change the story around to get to the end result. It didn't even really change the end of the story. Like, no, nothing in the story changed.
Mm-hmm.
It was just compressed. It was like reading an abridged version of a book versus the full.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how I felt too. I mean, coming from, you know, not reading the book for a long time, it was really rushed. Like I didn't get a strong sense of where Ender was coming from in terms of his rebellion against authority, or even his relationship with his siblings was really kind of side plotted.
Like, whereas in the book, they make a big deal. It's a big deal about how, you know, Ender's feelings towards Peter and how Ender adores Valentine, his sister, but he's every time that he resorts to violence, he's afraid of becoming what his brother is.
Because in the book it was that intense and that scary. His relationship with his brother was that scary.
Well, I mean,
he was on the verge of death a couple of times. I mean, remember reading it.
His brother, so kids would play, you know, astronauts versus buggers, as they call them. They called the Formics buggers.
The violent
version. So like, you know, kids would put on these bugger masks and his brother would chase him around. And then when he finally get him down, he basically choke him and saying things like, you know, you bugger, you know, you're here to destroy us, all this stuff. And it's one of those things that in the movie, they really don't get across the true violence of that relationship. They do a little bit, but they don't get across how violent Peter is. In the book, they go into later in the book, they go into things like he would go out into the woods and take small animals like squirrels, stake them down, and fillet them alive.
Yeah.
And Valentine feeling like it's better that he take out his aggression there than on other kids.
Yeah.
And so the book takes things very, very far with regards to Ender's relationship with Peter, his mm-hmm. relationship with Valentine, and how all of that worked into Ender becoming the ultimate savior of humanity, but at the same time becoming the ultimate genocide, you know, the cause of the genocide of the Formics. Mm-hmm. The movie, I thought they did as good of a job as you can do of taking this type of a book and putting it into one movie.
Yeah, I mean, and hearing about this film being made, I mean, it was one of the things that said was Orson Scott Card thought that this was the best adaptation that they got to, and that's why the film was made. I mean, since it was publication in 1985. I mean, they've been trying to make this film, and they've been trying to doing it. And
it's been on and off for 10 years.
And then, I guess, Orson Scott Card co-founded Fresco Pictures in 1996. And since then, he's been trying to... He just ended up writing the film himself. He's one of the writers on the film in the screenplay.
Which I think is one of the reasons they didn't change the story at all.
Like, yeah. But
they left some stuff out, but they did not change the ending, or they did not change stuff in the story. There's only one change that I thought about after I went back and reread the book. Bernard. In the book, Bernard is one of the cohorts that goes with Bonzo to basically...
Remind me who Bernard was.
Bernard is the one, he kind of longish blonde hair, that was one of his...
Oh, yeah.
You remember, one of the guys that went to command school, and he was one of the sub guys with Petra and Bean.
The blonde kid
with the attitude.
Yeah.
When he was in Dragon Army, he basically said, like, why am I here? You don't even like me. In the book, Bernard is one of the ones that goes with Bonzo to teach Ender a lesson.
Mm.
So in the book, Bernard is basically just... You know, he's one of the antagonists against Ender. He does not end
even
up,
more so in the film. I mean, even more so than the film.
Well, yeah, because in the film they basically reconcile, and Bernard ends up being one of his trusted lieutenants in command school. Because in command school, it's like Ali, Bean, Petra, Bernard,
mm-hmm.
Dink. That's what it was. Yeah. Dink Meeker.
Great names.
I know, it's fantastic. So that's one change that I did notice. But again, it's one of those things where the overall story itself didn't really change much.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a detail that changed. Actually, I think the biggest change was what they did to Ender's character, making him a little less of a final, like, I'm going to do what I have to do to survive. And if that means mm-hmm. kicking somebody while they're down to the point where nobody will ever mess with me because of it, you know, they kind of did away a little bit of that with his character. And I realized that, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, 10-year-olds, you're not going to have a PG-13 movie showing 10-year-olds killing each other.
Yeah, that's getting into, oh my gosh, oh, what crap, what's the movie? The kids on the island by themselves, law.
I have no idea. It's Peter Pan?
Oh, crap, I can't even remember. It's the famous book that every kid reads about the kids on the island.
The kids on the island, Jurassic Park.
Kids.
I have absolutely
the chubby kid with the frog. Oh my gosh, I can't remember.
Chubby kid with the frog. If I type into Google "chubby kid with frog," what's going to come up?
I'm going blank on the book.
Frog. Anyway, hang on. Let's see if Chubby Kid with Frog comes up with anything.
I don't even know if the frog is a good reference. But I mean, that's
apparently
all.
There's actually a thing called a chubby frog that you can like buy at Petco. It's kind of weird.
But that, I mean, it's how I felt about the film too. Was, I mean, it was very bullet pointed, but I felt going from, I mean, I thought the pace of it and the feel of the film was kind of fun, and I mean the visuals were great, but again it felt bullet pointed, like the characters just existed on, they never got to a certain point where I wanted them to go, because all of a sudden we have to go to this next piece of the film.
Well, I think that this would have been best done as, say, a 3 or 4 part miniseries, 2 hours each. Mm-hmm. You would have the
even another film, like a 2-parter film, which is hard to do.
The background.
It's hard
where Ender goes to the battle school, mm-hmm. and all the background that leads up to that. Then you have battle school. Then you have command school. Then you have the aftermath where, again, they don't even touch on the end of the book in the movie.
Yeah, I mean,
end of the book, Ender goes happened? To the home planet. So in the movie, he finds the egg on that moon, on the asteroid. He finds the queen there.
Show him go off in the ship.
Yes. In the book, Valentine comes up to that asteroid, goes with him, and they become colonists to the bugger homeworld.
Oh,
and
really?
Ender is the governor. Ender becomes the governor of the Ender homeworld, of the colonists that are there. That's when he starts to have these dreams and stuff, and he goes out and finds this egg of this queen. And then at this point, he's an adult. So now he's a 30 or 40 year old adult, and that's when he talks to Valentine. And then what they don't also say,
I can't remember that part.
They don't actually say in the book, but when you read the later books, basically in the later books, Ender and Valentine hop around the universe or around the galaxy to various planets. Ender's like 50,000 years old because of relativity, still looking for a place for this queen. He becomes a speaker for the dead. They don't ever get into the whole speaker for the dead thing, which in the in the book, he's the speaker for the dead, which is, you know, he becomes a speaker for the dead for the Formix.
Because the Formix, he never lands the queen anywhere.
In the book,
yeah.
In the books, I'm trying to think I think he does in the books. It's been a long time since I've read. There are 4 books in the series total.
Okay.
There's four books in that series.
At the end.
And then there's the Shadow series, where there's Ender's Shadow that actually follows the character Bean through battle school and the command school and all this stuff. There's Shadow of the Hegemon, I don't know how you say that, which follows Peter. There's 7 or 8 books written in this universe.
But at the end of the first book, where does it end in the first book?
In the first book, it ends with an adult Ender and an adult Valentine traveling off from the bugger homeworld, the colony that they had set up there.
Because they actually landed and we see them at the bugger homeworld.
In the book, yes.
We
see him there for 50 years or 30 years or however long it is. So in the book, basically him and Valentine as adults take off to travel the world to find basically like in Ender's eyes, redemption for his sins, kind of.
Wow.
Yeah. Like I said, this to me is why this book is so amazing. This book on its surface can be read by a third grader.
Mm-hmm.
A third grader can read this book and understand the basic, like, kid goes to battle school, fights, has problems, goes to command school, you know, and the end result.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much more that can be interpreted and discovered. And that's one thing I love about this book is that it's not that you're not having to interpret signs. It's not like you're reading the book and then having to go, you know, I think that the bacon that Ender makes is symbolic of the struggle with his... There are a lot of books out there that use a lot of symbology where you have to make inferences towards like, well, I think this is meant to mean this. This is not a book like that. This is a book where... to get the most out of the book, you have to be able to read it and then kind of understand what they're trying to say. But there's a difference to me between just obscure symbology of, you know, I'm trying to think. There was a book I had to read in high school called Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And in one scene, she's playing a piano. The next scene, she's out in a field with a baby. And apparently, I found out, because I failed that test, that... her playing the piano in that scene with somebody else sitting there was symbolic of her getting raped. I have absolutely no understanding of how anybody gets that from that.
And you know what? I got a bachelor's of science in comparative literature and cinema studies.
Wouldn't that be a bachelor of arts?
I mean, yeah, sorry. Bachelor of Arts.
Okay, I was confused there for a second.
I just wanted to sound smarter. where I spent classes watching films and we're talking about films, and really what it comes down to is somebody's perspective on what they think it means. Because, like I've said before, like I've probably said a couple times on this podcast, there have been directors who have said, oh, this person thought this was my film? I had no idea. Like, I thought it was cool.
It's like people... In one of the later hardcover editions of Ender's Game, Orson Scott Card writes an introduction that basically says, like, people want to interpret things that... Fine, if people want to interpret things, that's great, but... Mm-hmm. This book is meant to be exactly what it is. It is not meant to have any obscure symbology where it's like you have to try to see, like, what's the symbology of Ender walking on the right side of the hallway? Does that mean that is this meant to be a book about the right wing versus the left wing in politics? Like, a lot of people do this with Lord of the Rings, where it's like Mordor is meant to be the Nazi, you know, regime and all this stuff. This is not a book that Orson Scott Card ever intended there to be any inferences on what his meaning was behind things.
I got a book for like my birthday or Christmas one year where it was the theology behind Lord of the Rings, like the religious aspects of the film. You can go so far with your thoughts and theology and all this stuff, but sometimes it's just what it is.
Like, yeah, exactly. And I mean, Orson Scott Card came out and said that. Now, Orson Scott Card, in the last 5 years, has become a very polarizing figure. He's come out and said some very controversial statements religiously and all this kind of stuff. So
I would hope so.
Like him or hate him, I don't know. I guess I'm able to just separate the person's personal beliefs from what I feel the book was meant to be. And he wrote the book 18 years ago. He wrote the book. So, to me, the book is not any bearing on what his current political beliefs are. I don't care what his current political beliefs are. Or religious or whatever you want to call it. I like the book for what it is. Mm-hmm. And it will always be one of my favorite books. I think it says a lot. It says a lot without trying to be obscure. And I think there are a lot of books out there that try to be obscure in what they mean.
I mean, it's just straight up. I'm going to have to listen to the audiobook. A good audiobook. I'm going to have to find a good audiobook of this and listen to it.
Audible.com. We'll probably have a good one. If Audible wants to sponsor the podcast, feel free to let us know.
Audible.com, where you can listen to Ender's Game in its full potential.
In its full potential? Anyway. All right.
I don't know. I was...
Yeah.
I'll work on that audible.com. Thank you for sponsoring the show.
If only we made anything off of this show, that would be fantastic.
We got to get back into a regular
schedule. A regularly scheduled broadcast.
Whatever. Anyway. I don't think there's anything else.
I mean, to sum it all up, I think that we both enjoyed the movie. It definitely was a bullet point version of what you get out of the book. And I highly recommend that people read this book. I mean, I would recommend this book almost over Lord of the Rings.
Well, I mean, would you say to watch the film first, then read the book? Or, I mean, like you're saying, if you saw the film, you'd be like, oh, great, I want to go read the book now. Or the book and then go see the... abridged version of theaters.
This is an interesting thing because most of the time I would say read the book first and then watch the movie so that you don't spoil the book for yourself by watching a crappy movie first. It's like read the really good book first, then watch the movie was about the book, but meh, at least you got the good thing first. This is one of those cases where I actually think that for people that have never read the book, watching the movie to me, good enough that it should be like, wow, that was cool. Now let me see all of the stuff that happened between all of those bullet points. I want to see the depth to this story now.
I feel like I feel like you can go about it with other, well, it depends on how, what, like Lord of the Rings. if you watched the Lord of the Rings films and then read the books, I mean, you could go out from like, all right, now you have these visuals in your head. You can go read in more detail what happened, you know, yeah. in between these, you know, the cuts, you know.
Well, the one problem with watching a movie first is it then limits your imagination.
It's true.
In the
That's
book.
True. Exactly.
When I read the book, I imagined all of these things about the battle room and all this stuff. And the movie just kind of honed what I was thinking into reality.
But if I
had watched the movie first and then read the book, like the book would have just been details about the visuals that I had from the movie.
I honestly think for myself, I would have a better experience reading the book first, letting my imagination go crazy, and then watching the film and you sort of get like, all right, you get this little teeny global you get this little sense of maybe something you imagined, like a little piece that you imagined, but then, you know, kind of honed into one specific view. I think watching the film first in any sense will limit what you're reading, because all of a sudden you're reading and you're like, all right, this happened.
I do think though that for me, like, some people just have a more vivid imagination than others. If you're the type of person that doesn't like to read first because you just can't picture things, by all means, go watch this movie. Watch the movie, and then once you have the faces and the voices of the characters, read the book. Envision these characters saying all these extra things and doing these extra things.
Because you're not gonna have this story that veers off in a totally different direction.
Exactly. It's not completely different.
You're just gonna have it bullet pointed.
But if you are someone that enjoys to read and enjoys a story that you can visualize, read the book first, then go watch the movie.
Mm-hmm. One thing we haven't covered is kind of this world that is depicted. So we have, and you have to help me with this in terms of, so I mean, we're on Earth. I mean, because in the book, I can't remember how much description we get of life on Earth at this point.
Life on Earth is basically what we get from life on Earth is that humanity itself has banded together with this like international fleet and what they call the Warsaw Pact. Mm-hmm. Which is basically all of the nations banding together to, prevent another invasion attack from the Formics.
Yeah.
Population controls have been put into place. Because
there was an attack on
Earth. Only two children are allowed per family. Anyone else above and beyond that have to be requisitioned from the government, basically saying like, hey, I would like to have permission to have a third child.
And that's more of a governmental decision to try to decrease
population, as well as we only want children being born that are brilliant enough to potentially help save humanity. So Ender was allowed to be requisitioned because Peter was brilliant but violent. Mm-hmm. Valentine was brilliant but too empathetic.
So perhaps
they were hoping that a third child would be the combination that they needed. The violence and the ruthless self-preservation of Peter combined with the empathetic nature of Valentine.
Well, we point that out, but who's to say that the first or second child is going to be the top of the line kid,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Like there's not. Usually the thirds are just requisitioned when the first and the second are part of what they think they might need. And they think that, well, let's give it a third shot, basically.
I feel like in the sense of having two children is more of a to decrease the population in the long run.
Yes, absolutely.
the smartest child available kind of thing. Another reason I love this kind of premise is the fact that we are on kids. Like this decision has been made that kids are our only survival. So we have this sort of kid story about the end. And I like, you know, it takes place within, it's kind of this micro it's like this micro story about, you know, this group of people in space rather than sort of a more global, you know, on Earth story.
Yeah. Well, they actually talk about that a couple times in the book where they, like, the battle school almost becomes this, they forget what they're fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
And Ender, that's why they take him back to Earth at one point and have him talk to Valentine, because Ender forgets, like,
which it's was almost in film, like for which these, was in the movie.
For these kids, it's like battle school becomes what it's all about. The battles between the other armies, with the other armies, becomes what it's all about. And they forget that, hey, we're fighting, that we're all on the same team. We're fighting so that we can find the best person to help defend Earth. And it becomes more about the I'm better than you. My team, my army is better than yours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they then take Ender back to Earth for, and have him meet with Valentine, is to remind him, hey, this is what you're fighting for.
Yeah. I want to play one of the clips from the film. This is where Graf is talking to Ender outside of his house. I believe this is after Graf talks to his family, but trying to get Ender to come up with him. And I want to play this clip.
The Formix might have wiped us out the last time, you know. A brilliant commander is the only thing that saved us. We need minds like yours, Ender. Young people integrate complex data more easily than adults. If there's a chance that because of you, the Formix might leave us alone forever, then I have to ask you to come with me.
It's what I was born for, right?
There's Harrison Ford, and one thing we haven't talked about was Harrison Ford.
Forgot to talk about Harrison Ford being Colonel Graf.
Did you like him as
Yes.
Graf?
I actually thought he did very, very well as Colonel Graf. He played the gruff commander very well.
Yeah.
The one thing we haven't talked about yet is that character, Colonel Graf. There are numerous times where there's another character, Major Anderson, where she is very much like we're destroying these kids. And Colonel Graf is like, look, if it takes destroying a few kids to save humanity, that's what we will do. Like, kind of this thing of, it goes back into that humanity thing of, like, you know, if you could kill 5 people to save a million, would you do it?
Mm-hmm.
And that gets into morality questions and all kinds of other stuff. And it's an interesting
in the film
topic.
And the book. Yeah, I mean, in the film and the book, I mean, it's all over the place. I mean, just in terms of these battles that he's actually,
well,
he thinks he's, you know, playing a game, but
the thing that Colonel Graf constantly brings up in the book and a little bit in the movie, but he constantly brings up, is that Ender must always feel like he can only rely on himself.
Mm-hmm.
No one, no adult will ever step in to save him.
Yeah.
Because when he becomes the commander of the fleet and it's down to him against the enemy,
Nobody can step in. Mm-hmm.
There is nothing that anybody, and the problem is that what they were saying is Ender must feel that even when he thinks it's a simulation, nobody is going to step in to help him.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that that simulation is not a simulation, it's reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't let him think that because it's a simulation, we're going to step in and make it easier for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's why they let him get into dangerous situations where he may have gotten killed or things like that, because he had to feel like, to preserve himself,
he had to
do it for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody else was going to help him. And the book actually goes into a lot more detail about that feeling of, like, his realization of that fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I
think that's one of the things that I missed in the film, was that, like, a greater sense of his moral choices that he was making because of these reasons.
Yeah.
Or the fact that, you know, why he was rebelling against authority. That was a part of the film, was, you know, there was one scene in the dormitory rooms.
Dab, where he's like, I have a legitimate question.
What if I have a legitimate question? And he's like, you know, speak unless spoken to.
Don't speak unless spoken to.
And he, you know, I mean that whole sense of Ender, you don't really get in the film a sense of where that's coming
from. And that's what I mean when I say the movie does a good job of portraying the bullet points of the story. It does not do a good job of getting across the emotional, moral, and psychological values and decisions that Ender and the other characters make. The book does a good job of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of the book is, like we said earlier, I mean, you know, his relationship with his brother and his sister, and decisions he's making are made for a reason. And, like, yeah, in the film, you don't exactly get a sense of its origin.
Yeah.
But you do get a sense of sort of where it's coming from, and it's portrayed, but not to an extent, obviously, in that the book took on.
Agreed. Okay. Well, I think that we have kind of put this one to I'm of the opinion this is a movie that you could have college courses on.
Yeah. You should.
Whether it's from tactics to whatever. But I think that we've, you know, for a podcast, we've kind of covered the basics of it, and I hope that it will spark some people thinking and some people reading the book out there.
And on our Facebook page, we posted this. I was thinking about whether to talk about this, but we haven't watched the new Hunger Games at all yet, so I don't think we should talk about it.
Maybe we'll talk about it next episode.
The Wired issue where it talks in terms of sort of a more military stance on, you know, how this world is kind of portrayed. Maybe next month, because we can talk about when do we want to talk about. Do we want to talk about next month now or a little bit later?
Well,
what do we have next? We have.
Let's do that now. All right. So, finalizing the
Ender's great.
Ender's Game discussion. Yeah. We really like the movie. Definitely bullet pointed version. Go read the book. If you like the movie even a little bit, go read the book and you'll be absolutely amazed. I mean, it was a Hugo Award winner. I think it was a Nebula Award winner.
Probably.
Just a fantastic book. So.
And the film, for what it was good. You know, it felt rushed and the characters were a little thin, but the visuals were great. It was fun seeing the battle room sort of visualized, to an actual
screen. That was cool.
I thought that was good. The characters I thought were well acted. To their best of the ability, to their minimalist versions, basically. It was fun. It was good. I want to talk to Derek more about.
I know. I'm interested to talk to him.
What he actually thought about it? Because yeah.
Okay. But, well, that concludes our conversation about Ender's Game. That brings up
Ender's Game. Oh yeah. Did you actually think about this?
Well, kind of. Not really. So.
I like how you just like cut it off halfway.
So we're not doing any trivia, but there are a couple quotes. So this is going to be the segment where I just bring up random things. Sometimes it's a quiz with Niall. Sometimes it's random quotes.
All right, good.
So there are a couple quotes that I really, really liked.
How about this quote?
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass.
Not quite that type of quote. So in the movie, Colonel Graf says, "Tell me why you kept on kicking him. You had already won." Mm-hmm. That's referring to when Ender was continuing to kick Bonesaw.
Yeah.
Ender goes, "Knocking him down won the first fight. I want to win all the next ones too, so they'd leave me alone."
And I think that line right there says why Ender is the kid.
And that's why he made that decision at the end. Yeah. Defeating their armies was one thing, but by taking out their planet, it defeated all the future battles to come.
Yeah.
There was another one where Ender says, "In the moment when I truly understand my enemy, understand him well enough to defeat him, then in that very moment, I also love him." Mm-hmm. So that goes into that whole thing of in order to understand your enemy well enough to defeat him, you have to have enough empathy to actually feel like you love him. Mm. Like it requires that devotion to your enemy to be able to understand them well enough to defeat him. And then there was a back and forth that I really liked between Ender and Colonel Graf and Anderson. Ender says, "Sir, you made me hate them." Colonel Graf says, "I told them you were the best. We need a Julius Caesar, a Napoleon." Major Anderson says, "We were hoping that would be you." Ender says, "Caesar was assassinated by the people he trusted." And Major Anderson says, "And Napoleon lost in the end." And then Colonel Graf goes, not before he conquered the known world. Dismissed. Mm-hmm. So basically he was saying, you're right. Napoleon and Caesar were both betrayed by the people they trusted or destroyed in the end, but not before they accomplished what they needed to. Mm-hmm. Basically, he was telling Ender, look, we recognize we are giving you a difficult time, but in the end, all that matters is that you save humanity.
Mm-hmm.
As long as that happens.
And there's another quote. I remember watching this in the trailer, but Viola Davis's character, what's her name? The other
Valentine?
No.
Anderson. I think it was Anderson was supposed to be her character.
But she's like, we're destroying these kids, and you know, does that matter? And it's like, and Colonel Graf is like, what does it matter if there's nothing left?
That's true. It's one of those, what does it matter if we save the kid as if the entire planet is gone?
As long as we accomplish, yeah. I mean, that's a big theme throughout the book, and I mean, and the film is, you know,
they definitely make a lot more in the book about that whole thing than they do in the movie.
For sure.
Okay, that means it's time for.
Yeah, what the? Well, we already know.
Well, we know one of them.
No, we know both.
We do.
We remember we decided this.
Oh crap. okay, so next month we are going to be watching Hunger Games: Catching Fire,
along with. So we've decided.
Have we not watched the first Hunger Games?
We haven't watched it for this episode.
Oh right. So next month we're going to do one episode on the first two movies of the Hunger Games trilogy.
So basically, we were talking about this. We're like, well, so Hunger Games, the new Hunger Games: Catching Fire film just came out, and. You know, we might as well talk about it while it's, you know, big, and, you know, I hear it's pretty awesome too. But we might as well talk about the first one while we're at it. Because, I mean, why are we going to talk about the new one when we haven't talked about
exactly.
the first one? So, basically, December is going to be our Hunger Games episode. And, I mean, we might as well talk about the books while we're at it.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
You've read
the books. I've read the books, and I'll actually probably reread the books for the episode for next month.
I might need to.
So yeah, what we'll do is the first part of the episode will be the first part of the episode will be about the first book. The second part will be about Catching Fire.
That's right.
And we'll go from there.
Lauren, it is a Hunger Games episode.
Lauren,
just for you.
This episode's for you,
and probably Derek and many other people.
Yeah.
But yeah, we figured we might as well just talk about Hunger Games, and then we can probably talk about It'll just be all.
All right,
Hunger
so there.
Games.
There are two movies for our next episode, The Hunger Games and The Hunger Games: Catching Fire.
And then January we will return to all random awesomeness.
Okay, well that about does it for this episode. We want to thank everyone for listening. It's been a while and it's good to be back.
Obviously, usually we have Mark on the show. And due to the holidays, he couldn't be here. So
he will be back.
Happy holidays to his family and himself. Thank you, Mark Helen. And we'll see you on the other side.
Indeed. So you guys can get a hold of us, feedback@dystopicradio.com. You can find us on Twitter @dystopicradio or on Facebook or on iTunes. You can give us a call. Leave us a voicemail. We would love to hear your feedback.
Please.
206-414-9309. Niles, what do you got to say?
What do I have to say? Well, I have to say we are on the verge of Black Friday apocalypse, and please be safe and do not get more than you can carry in one shopping cart, because you're going to have a hard time getting away from zombies or whatever else comes.
All I got to say is don't beat anybody up for a TV. We will.
Please. See you guys on the other side.
What?
See you on the side.
See you guys on the other side.
See you on the side.
You see, I take these glasses off. Moon's for balls.
This broadcast has been brought to you by the Dystopic Radio Network and survivors like you.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass.
Kick ass!